Emptiness.
Can you say that?
Emptiness.
Can you?
Emptiness. Emptiness. 10 billion years of evolution. Revolution. Revolution.
Hi, this is Enemy Combatant Radio News. I'm broadcasting from Indie Media in San Francisco, and we do the new show here on Pirate Cat 87.9 FM every Monday from 7 to 8 p.m. Also up in here, Christina.
Howdy.
Oh.
There. Howdy.
And some other folks sitting in the studio today. Welcome to Enemy Combatant Radio. If you guys want to go on the air later in the show, you're welcome to. But if you want to practice reading the calendar events or something. So we're going to be bringing you some news stories off of the Indie Media news wires from the past week, and we're going to start off with a story about Kevin Benderman, who is a 10-year soldier. I think he's a soldier. Is he an officer? Soldier, I think.
He's a sergeant.
Sergeant. Does that make you a soldier or an officer?
That's a good question.
But he's in the U.S. Army, and he's just been court-martialed for attempting to become a conscientious objector and attempting to somehow make a statement against the war in Iraq. And actually, he refused to go serve in Iraq after serving there previously. And so he's just been sentenced to 15 months in jail. And so we're going to listen to a report from ECR's own Sarah Olson, who actually filed this report with Free Speech Radio News.
Army Sergeant and Iraq War veteran Kevin Benderman was sentenced to 15 months in prison yesterday for refusing to fight the war in Iraq. After a six-month tour of duty in Iraq in 2003, He filed for conscientious objector status shortly before his unit redeployed in January of 2005. His request was rejected, and Benderman was court-martialed for desertion. Benderman says nothing he did during peacetime prepared him for going to war.
There's just no way to describe being in a war zone unless you've been there. You know, I mean, I can sit here and talk to you about it, but I can't really give you the impact of what it's like unless you're there and you see and you hear and you smell it all yourself. It's insanity.
Monica Benderman is Kevin's wife. Since Kevin was charged, they've been traveling around the country together, speaking out against the war. She says Kevin's struggle is bigger than his loss today.
I know that we have to take a stand, not just for him, but for all the soldiers that are going through that struggle, because there's a part of every soldier that's saying this war is wrong. So I think it's important for us to speak out to make that point.
Monica and Kevin are not alone in speaking out on behalf of Iraq War veterans and against the ongoing war in Iraq. Camilla Mejia was an Army staff sergeant who spent 9 months in prison for his refusal to return to the war. He says in a time when recruiting is down and public sentiment is increasingly against the war, the military is trying to send a political message to the over 5,000 soldiers who have already deserted.
It's not going to be until soldiers like Kevin Benderman decide to put their weapons down that this war is going to stop. As long as they got people who are willing to follow illegal orders and fight illegal and immoral wars, we're going to have a war.
The movement of soldiers who refuse to return to the war is gaining momentum, according to Aiden Delgado, another Iraq War veteran and conscientious objector. He believes the military is trying to hide the level of resistance happening among rank-and-file soldiers.
They want to project this image of everything's fine, there's no cracks in the facade, there's no dissent, but the real truth is that Kevin's not the first CO who refused to go to Iraq. He certainly won't be the last. I think they're doing everything they can to just stem the tide. They're just trying to pretend like nothing's wrong, like nobody is objecting to this war. And the truth is, even, you know, the sergeants who are the perfect face of the Army are objecting to the war.
While some in the military say Benderman is a coward, according to Amy Allison, a Persian Gulf War conscientious objector and military counselor, a growing number of soldiers disagree.
When we look at the length of time that Kevin Benderman was given, it's the longest sentence in this war. It means the military is getting more and more threatened. I know from my personal counseling, I know from the tens of thousands of calls that the GI Rights Hotline gets every month, that this is going to continue to be more of an issue.
Kevin Benderman says he stands in solidarity with other soldiers and continues to believe it's his moral and ethical duty to resist war.
So all war is basically the same thing and is designed to kill as many people as possible. And that is the insanity that we need to get away from in this day and age.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Olson.
Alright, another report that we got in recently at Indie Bay is that Nabilone Bakery, which is a well-known worker-owned bakery in Berkeley, is possibly going to be closing. It's one of the oldest collective businesses running in Berkeley. Of course, there used to be many more collective businesses and co-ops in a previous generation here in the Bay Area. Right now, Nabilone Bakery is seeking to raise $50,000. They have supported progressive causes for many years by distributing free pastries, hosting events, hosting artists' work at the cafe, and more recently providing free Wi-Fi access. They've provided decent jobs with worker control over their conditions to dozens of activists who have been working in various political movements. Financial mismanagement forced the bakery into debt about 4 years ago, and it has been attempting to recover ever since. There's going to be a town hall meeting at Nabilone tonight from 7 to 9 p.m. That's on Russell Street, just east of College Avenue in Berkeley. He'll be discussing what the community can do to possibly save the bakery. They're trying to find people in the community to pledge $500 to $1,000 in sustainer certificates, which would enable the bearers to 10% discounts on bakery products. And that would give enough of a cash infusion for the bakery to keep going. In other news, people in the Bay Area are starting to work towards organizing Starbucks workers. Right now, that is still pretty much an underground organizing drive. Over on the East Coast, there's been a prominent case of a union organizer, Sarah Bender, who was terminated from the Starbucks in Manhattan at 17th Street and 1st Avenue for her union organizing activity. This is the first time since the founding of the Starbucks Workers Union that the company actually took the step of firing one of the union organizers, the pretext being that she allegedly came out $6 short on her cash register. Management learned that Sarah was involved with the workers' union after she hosted a party, which was attended by some union members. And since then, the company started disciplining her to build a case for firing her. And she is in need of financial assistance as she contemplates a legal defense against being fired. And actually, there's a call-in campaign going on today, August 1st. They're trying to get people to call in to Starbucks to say that they support workers being able to organize in the workplaces and to let the management know that people are paying attention to this issue. And the phone number to call in is area code 212-613-1280. It's area code 212-613-1280, extension 2202. And that's from the labor news at indiebay.org.
And also, recently, an 11-year-old girl, Maribel Cuevas, who speaks more Spanish than English, has been criminalized for defending herself against being attacked by two neighborhood boys who were throwing water balloons at her. She threw a rock at one of the boys, and it landed and hit one of the children on the head. And 11-year-old Maribel Cuevas was arrested and sent to juvenile hall, where she spent 5 days. She's currently being charged with felony assault with a deadly weapon. Her trial will begin on August 3rd, this Wednesday. Her lawyer has accused the police of criminalizing childhood behavior. Women's rights activists are encouraging people to write to the district attorney, Elizabeth A. Egan, and ask her to drop the charges against Maribel Cuevas. And, of course, this happened in Fresno. Not of course. It could happen anywhere. This is childhood behavior that her attorney claims is being criminalized. There was a press conference held on Friday, the 29th, at the Fresno County Courthouse. And, again, her trial starts on Wednesday, August 3rd.
Okay, so scrolling down here, you may have heard the news that CAFTA passed in the House of Representatives just narrowly by a 217 to 215 vote. This is going to be expanding the North American Free Trade Agreement to Central America and the Dominican Republic. And there were huge, massive protests across Central America against CAFTA. In fact, several people died during those protests in Guatemala. There wasn't much of a protest here in the U.S. There was basically an effort to call Congress people and get them to vote against CAFTA by Global Exchange and many other organizations. Apparently, that campaign was not quite enough, and CAFTA passed Congress.
And what was the margin on that? It was, 115 to 117 votes? It was slim.
Yeah, it was one vote, because if there had been a tie, then it would not have passed. And so it was 217 to 215, and if otherwise it would have been 216 to 216. So it was really down to the wire, and it sounds like things were really crazy on the floor of Congress. Some votes maybe weren't recorded. There's some reports about that on Democracy Now! which people may have heard. But basically, right now, Bush and the rest of the supporters of free trade are angling to extend it even further with the Andean Free Trade Agreement, or AFTA. And this is probably going to be even more unpopular amongst even North Americans. And so I guess a lot of anti-corporate globalization activists are hoping that that will finally put an end to this progression of NAFTA across the Western Hemisphere.
This neoliberal policy. There's also been talk that there's going to be a MEFTA. Of course, that was groups like the International Forum on Globalization had mentioned MEFTA in the past, like about 1 or 2 years ago, which would be the Middle East Free Trade Agreement. That's yet to go through any sort of legislature, but I'm wondering when. It's not a matter of if, it's just a matter of when.
Well, it seems like the Middle East right now, they have a lot more to worry about than free trade. But in other local news, the Northern California bricklayers and stonemasons have been out on strike. The bricklayers union is called BAC, and they've been basically in negotiation with the new contract to get health care, retiree benefits, pension funding, and travel compensation. And this includes 3,000 bricklayers, stonemasons, tile layers, and finishers, caulkers, marble setters, and all kinds of other people, a long list of people who are in this union, which actually I hadn't heard about until they went on strike. So hopefully we can keep covering that story.
And Father Gerard Jean Juste was arrested and charged with murder of a friend in Haiti. He was present at the funeral of Haitian journalist Jacques Roche on July 21st. And as Jean Juste entered the chapel, he was shouted and called names such as assassin. He was beaten by people in the crowd, and security officers helped him to leave. He was met by UN police and brought into a police station where he was questioned and eventually charged with killing Roche. He has been held in isolation since July 21st and has not been allowed to meet with his attorney. On July 25th, Amnesty International declared Gerard Jean Juste a prisoner of conscience. He is being held in isolation in the Haitian National Penitentiary. And we have an interview coming up here, so we'll take a break. You're listening to Indie Bay, the Enemy Combatant Radio, and our weekly newscast broadcast on Pirate Cat Radio 87.9 FM. We're going to take a break here. This is Freedom's Waiting from Negative Land, and we'll be back with an interview from Mark is going to conduct.
Yeah, we're going to speak briefly with someone from the California Coalition Against Poverty, which is having a new campaign against slumlords in Oakland.
All right.
The strongest word. The strongest word. The strongest word.
Persuasive.
The strongest word. The strongest word.
Inspirational words.
The strongest word is still the word free.
Grateful words.
Free. The word free.
The strongest
word is still the word free.
Men have lived for words.
Men
have died for words.
Pointed
words. Cities have fallen for words.
Free.
The right words.
Iraq, inflammable.
The right words.
Islam, insidious.
The right words, said Lenin, are worth 100 regiments.
Freedom's waiting.
Infamous chorus.
Scathing words.
You can say 4 blunt words and a man will hit you in the face.
Words.
Freedom's waiting.
Israelic words.
Words.
Dirty. a little deluge of adjectives,
words.
The strongest word is still the word free.
Free.
Next to the word free, the best word is new.
Persuasive
word. The best word is new. New. New.
At your 7-Eleven, freedom's waiting.
For your kind of morning, our kind of freedom.
For you.
Other tested words are mistakes.
Freedom. Stop. Freedom. Freedom. Freedom.
This is how we ride and roll. Soldier for life for sure.
Alright, this is Enemy Combatant Radio coming at you on Pirate Cat 87.9 FM in San Francisco and also at enemycombatantradio.net. And we do the new show here every Monday from 7 to 8 p.m. And today we're speaking with Renee from the California Coalition Against Poverty. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, man. Thank you for having me.
Sure. Could you tell us a little bit about your group? Because I think it's a pretty new group, at least here in the Bay Area.
Yeah, we are inspired by the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, also known as OCAP. Some of our members were actually founding members of OCAP a few years ago. And we are a direct action, working class-based group of workers and poor people, and we believe in self-defense. We believe that in order to organize against abusive, unfair, and oppressive employers and landlords or slumlords, working people have to organize and fight back directly against them. So we believe that whenever people face problems, you know, like somebody's getting evicted or somebody's, let's say a worker, is not getting the money they should be getting, like, you know, there's cases where people are not being paid overtime or they are cutting their hours or that kind of thing. We believe in going to the source of the problem, which in this case is like the employers or the landlords or the city bureaucrats, you know, whatever it takes. We go to these persons and we just put pressure on them until they are, you know, they decide to become reasonable and sit down, negotiate, and act like they should be acting in the first place. So we organize public campaigns and direct actions against, you know, basically city officials, you know, employers, that kind of thing. We have we are originally based in San Diego in Southern California, but now we just started here in the Bay Area. We have in our first case, basically what we do is we do case work. Mm-hmm. So we take cases in the community, right? Whenever somebody's facing a situation, they give us a call. And so we evaluate the case, and then we decide to get involved. And we help the people fight back. I mean, we're not really like a group of lawyers or anything. We're just like workers and regular people. And we fight people to do whatever it takes and to fight to win against oppressive capitalist people, right? So we have our first case against this slumlord in Oakland, California, in the East Bay. Her name is Ellen Rodin, and she's a total slumlord. She's locking out some of her tenants in this property in Berkeley, and she refused to give them back their deposit money. And when some of her tenants came to us, we just thought that was unfair and that shouldn't be taking place, that somebody was, you know, being completely oppressive and unfair and illegal. So we decided to take matters, you know, to take action against her. So what we did is that we did some research on this lady. Her name is Ellen Rodin. So we found out that she was a lawyer. Actually, she was a liberal lawyer. She's into civil rights and all that stuff. And she has her office in downtown Oakland on 1611 Telegraph Avenue. So we approached her and said, you know what, we're the California Coalition Against Poverty, and we have decided to take this case, and we're going to sit down with you and your tenants, and we're going to, like, reach a fair, you know, settlement here. You know, you have to pay back the deposit and that kind of thing, right? So she has refused to do that, so we're organizing this public campaign against her. the first action that we did a couple of weeks ago was that we went to her office building and we flyered the entire building. We talked to all of her all the people who work in the same building, which are mostly nonprofits and lawyers, and we have the Jewish People for Peace there. We have the Renters Action Network. So there's a lot of lefty groups there, mm-hmm. and they were very receptive to the information we were bringing. Right, we were saying, you know, do you know that this Ellen Rodin, who occupies office number 1030, like here in this building, do you know that she's a slumlord? Do you know like all the things she's doing against her tenants? And they were very, very receptive, and we've been approached by two of her clients who are very, very concerned by her total lack of responsibility, and especially coming from a lawyer, right? So, this Friday, we're going to organize this picket line in front of her office. Again, it's going to be on 611 Telegraph Avenue in downtown Oakland at 4:15 o'clock. So that should be pretty interesting.
So now, has she responded to you guys already? Has she, sat down and talked with you or sent you a letter or anything like that?
Yes. She's been fairly condescending. The thing is, like, most of these lawyers and most of these, like, landlords, they're not really used to, like, tenants, like, organizing and fighting back for their rights, right, defending mm-hmm. their rights. So she's been totally denying, you know, any wrongdoings. She's been sending these letters, like, threatening us with charges of defamation and stuff. But, you know, the astonishing thing about landlords is that many times whenever they face direct action, whenever we start picketing their houses, because we do whatever it takes, you know, to make them act reasonable, right? So we research where they go to church. We research if they belong to any type of club, any type of organization. And we go them and we talk to, you know, the people they know, you know, so they know, you know, what kind of actions they're doing. So a lot of times they really don't know how to deal with this type of actions, you know. And in this case, it's been fairly condescending still. And actually, we just went today to her office, and we went all the way up to the 10th floor where she works, and she called security, and she didn't even come out of her office.
Wow.
So we just think that that's not really polite of her, you know, that we're just trying to talk to her. We're trying to settle this issue down, and she's refusing to talk to us, and just like she's just sending us letters saying that she didn't do anything wrong and that kind of thing. But we did some research, you know, when we took the case, and we found out that she has had a pattern of wrongdoings, of illegal actions against her tenants, and that's why we decided to help the tenants fight back, you know, to prevent any further damage and to try to get a compensation.
So how would you describe the history of using this tactic down in San Diego? Like, did you have a mixed record, or did you have a lot of successes, or what's the history?
Actually, yeah, I think we've been pretty lucky. I mean, we've been able to stop many evictions. We've been able to get many demands. I mean, actually, we never really lost a case. We only had a case where the person involved, this worker, didn't want to continue with the campaign. But I think it really talks about like people's power, you know, that when people decide to organize and fight together for a fair cause, they are very successful. And because people get really inspired whenever they're taking action in their own lives and they decide to, like, you know, do something about this system and try to fight back the system. And so they get really inspired, and that's really, like, a big motivation. And, for example, in San Diego, we picketed the house of the school superintendent for the district in San Diego. We also managed to stop, like I said before, several evictions. Also, we were working, and the thing is, like, once we work with the workers, we work with people, many times they end up joining CICAP, and that's how CICAP starts growing and growing. Like in San Diego, there's a branch still there, like doing work, and we just here, we started in Oakland, so we're definitely looking for people who want to get involved. Another case that we had in San Diego was that in this building owned by a church, by a Presbyterian church, it was all like low-income housing for elderly people, for, you know, for older folks. And the people there were getting abused, you know, they were getting threatened by the management and all that. There were issues of mail theft. So these elderly people came to us and say, you know, we want to do something to stop this abuse. You know, they're targeting us because we're elderly people. Mm-hmm. So we became involved, and we had this, like, we targeted the church, and the church finally, we took it to the entire congregation, and almost a lot of people in the building got organized, and it was very inspiring to see really strong fighters, you know, like 70, 60, 80-year-old people, like, you know, being part of this campaign. And as a result of that, a couple of them joined CCAP, and they're like some of the strongest fighters that
okay,
I've seen, you know. So
okay, Renee.
It's very inspiring, you know, to see this type of things
okay.
happening.
Renee, sorry, we gotta cut you off. We have another caller to get on the air. But thanks
okay, just to give my information, if you want to contact CCAP or you have any case, you can call 510-595-5545.
Okay, one more time.
510-595-5545.
Okay, thanks so much, Renee, and hopefully we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks a lot, Mark. We'll be there. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Bye.
See you later.
We are back. You're listening to Enemy Combatant Radio, and is broadcast over Pirate Cat 87.9 FM, and this is our weekly newscast. And on the line, we have Jesse Reynolds from the Center for Society and Genetics. Is that right, Jesse?
That's pretty close. Thanks, Christine. It's the Center for Genetics and Society.
Yes, that's right. Thank you.
Same words, opposite order.
So your group was dubbed Local Heroes by the Bay Guardian.
Yeah, that's in this year's Best of the Bay issue.
Mm-hmm.
And it came as something of a surprise and an honor, but we're we're happy nevertheless.
So can you tell us a little bit about the Center for Genetics and Society and why you were dubbed the local heroes for this year's Best of the Bay?
Well, the Center for Genetics and Society is a nonprofit advocacy organization based here in the Bay Area. And what we're concerned about is an emerging set of genetic technologies that when added together with certain reproductive technologies open the door to a future in the extreme form of human genetic engineering. And what we want to do is start a dialogue and implement policies that allow us to develop the best aspects of genetic and reproductive technologies, but not go down a road of human genetic engineering or reproductive cloning or designer babies and so forth. And so we got what led to the local heroes and getting involved with the San Francisco Bay Guardian goes to Proposition 71, which, to go back a few months, this was on the ballot last November here in California. It proposed to issue $3 billion, that's billion with a B, in bonds, state bonds, to fund stem cell research. And, well, we support stem cell research in a well-regulated context, but when we looked at the law, the proposed law, we were really concerned. It stacked the governing board with biotech executives and the leaders of institutions who would benefit directly from the money and didn't have representatives of the public interest. It had, you know, exceptions to open meetings laws and poor conflict of interest provisions. So in the end, we opposed Proposition 71 and we campaigned against it. And this was kind of a tough place to be. We're progressives and liberals and so forth here at the organization. And for the most part, liberals were lining up behind Proposition 71 as something of a slap in the face of the Bush administration. We talked to the Bay Guardian in November, and they ended up siding with us. They recommended to their voters to vote against 71. And they've done a couple of stories on the development since then. There was a cover story a few months ago called Sell Out, I believe. And so I think that's what led to the recognition.
Okay. Also, the SF Weekly in this past week's issue, they have a pretty detailed article about Proposition 71, and it also established the CIRM, which is the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, which is the body that will oversee and kind of allot the $3 billion in funds to different people who apply for grants for stem cell research, right?
Right, exactly, yeah. So Prop 71, it passed. It allocated the $3 billion in bonds. It will be managed by a new agency called the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine, or the CIRM. And it has a governing board. It's called
29 members.
Citizens Oversight Committee. We like to say the so-called Independent Citizens Oversight Committee because it's really neither independent nor citizens. It's entirely composed of representatives of institutions and constituencies that benefit by having stem cell research go forward at full speed with no holds barred.
So do you have, like, who's from what industry and who's doing what within the CIRM?
For example, the best example of what we feel is wrong with the composition of the board is in the chair and the vice chair.
Uh-huh.
Chair is Edward Penhote, who they say is a philanthropist, and he has been a president of a foundation, but he spent most of his life in the biotech industry. And he has founded 3 biotechnology companies, and he still holds at least $1 million in stock in each of these companies, as well as numerous other biotechnology companies. And also, for example, he's a paid partner at a venture capital firm that invests heavily in the biotech industry. So he's really he would be the poster child of the ultimate biotech corporate insider, and he's the vice chair of the committee.
So he would stand to benefit immensely by these $3 billion in grants, right?
Well, you know, it's tough to put a finger on it directly and personally and say he would benefit directly. I mean, some of the companies that he's invested in have connections to stem cell research. Now, but which companies are going to benefit directly is tough to say. That's why very early on we said, look, the people who are deciding how $3 billion should be spent, I mean, that's a lot of money for a state that's, you know, closing essential public health services and cutting back on education. These people, they should be, you know, absolutely clean, and they should divest of all biotechnology investments.
Okay, so there's a clear conflict of interest then.
I would think so.
So I have a question for you. I know a little bit about your group and some of your concerns, and I'd like to delve into one of those concerns. So you mentioned that California does, you know, we've been cutting back on education, on public health care and private health care, and I'm wondering how we're going to benefit from allotting $3 billion, or if we even will benefit.
That's a tough question. What this really comes down to are the agreements about intellectual property, which is sort of saying, okay, if there's a discovery, if there's an invention, who owns it, who sells it, who profits? Proposition 71 itself is very vague about how the intellectual property and thus any profits will be divided up between the grant recipient, which can be a university, public or private, nonprofit research institution, or a biotechnology company who can receive the grants directly. How will that be divided up with the state? And just now the governing board is starting to realize, oh my, we've got really the most tenuous issue, the most difficult issue right before it, and we have no idea. And it's turning into a very difficult and divisive one. Proposition 71 was advertised in, you know, on the website and in television ads as saying, well, there'll be returns to the state. If anything is invented, that the state will get a good-sized cut of the profits, and that'll help recoup some of the costs. But it's unclear if that's going to be the case. The other way the people of California might benefit is through the therapies itself, of course. But we're concerned that the type of therapies that are likely to be developed from stem cell research are likely to be very expensive, possibly around $100,000 or more. And so what we're pushing for, and we've had allies in the state Senate, notably Senator Deborah Ortiz, who is a big supporter of Prop 71, in fact, we're saying that the poor people in California, perhaps those who qualify for Medi-Cal, should have access to any therapies that their tax dollars paid for at affordable prices.
All right. So basically, because of let me see if I get this right. Because of the lax wording in the body of Proposition 71, what could happen is that California could spend $3 billion in stem cell research, and then have a university or a private corporation or an educator at a university do research and then patent that research, so that way they get the sole profits and the sole royalties of that findings. And California could essentially get nothing in return. And
right,
then they could turn around and charge an arm and a leg for the services that they've patented.
Yeah, that's exactly true. And unfortunately, what they're looking at as a model is that's what happens at the federal level. That's what the law says is going to be done. The federal law to govern this is called the Bayh-Dole Act, and it says, you know, the federal government, we don't want any profit. We are just trying to spur industry. And, well, you know, that's the law, and I don't agree with it, but that's fine. Prop 71 is different in that it was advertised to voters as saying, you know, the state will get its money back, and this is one of the ways that it will. So it's a different situation, and they cannot use this federal law as a model. They have to invent basically a whole new intellectual property law governing the funding of this research.
Also, what I find interesting in this article from SF Weekly is they're talking about the SF Weekly saying that there has been a number of Christian organizations, you know, who are anti-abortion groups, and they have filed lawsuits against Prop 71 on the basis that because it's getting state money, there is a state law that says it has to be regulated. And because Proposition 71 doesn't regulate, doesn't have a state body regulating where the money's going, it's tied up in court right now, which I think is kind of interesting. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. I mean, during the campaign, the most vocal opponents of Proposition 71 were those who oppose all embryonic stem cell research, you know, based upon their view that the embryo constitutes a full human life. We disagree with that. Our organization supports a woman's right to choose and does not agree with them about the status of the embryo. So we don't cooperate with those organizations, although we have the same message. It's for very different reasons. After the election, once Prop 71 passed, their goal, the anti-abortionists, they wanted to shut the whole thing down. So they're trying to tie it up in court, and they file lawsuits, not based upon the embryo, but California's constitution says if you spend state money, you have to be accountable to elected state officials. And the California Institute for Regenerative Medicine acts kind of like this semi-autonomous agency. There's no real state oversight. It prohibits the legislators from getting involved. So
wow.
we have not supported that lawsuit, although we think it makes some good points. But you know, in the end, we don't want to cooperate with who filed it. And at this point in time, we're not trying to stop the whole operation.
So we're going to wrap it up, Jesse. Thanks so much for calling. What in like 2 minutes, 3 minutes? What would the Center for Genetics and Society like to see happen at this time?
Well, you know, there's a number of things. Most of the problems we had with Proposition 71 could be addressed by the governing board of the Institute taking firm action on issues like conflict of interest, to have real disclosure in divestment policy for both the governing board and for its advisory groups, to have strong open meetings policies, to have policies that will protect the health of the research subjects, policies that will help guarantee a return to the state for any discoveries, and that all people of California will be able to access these discoveries, and to adopt research standards that really draw a clear line between what research is acceptable and what type of research crosses certain ethical boundaries that we don't want to cross. They still have that opportunity, so we encourage people to keep up to date on their activities and to attend the meetings and contact the board and give them their input.
And where are the next meeting?
If I can, I'll give a plug to our website. May I?
Yes, please do.
So we're the Center for Genetics and Society, and you can find us on the internet at www.geneticsandsociety.org, and we compile the relevant news about the Institute, and we also have an electronic newsletter that goes out about every other month, and that should help keep you updated.
When is the next ICOC, which is the Independent Citizens Oversight Committee, and they're the ones who are making the kind of the bylaws, when is their next meeting for public input?
Well, their next meeting of the full governing board is this Friday, and that's in San Diego. The meetings of the governing board move around the state.
When will it be in San Francisco?
However, the first meeting of the grants advisory group, this is the advisory group that will eventually say, fund this grant and not the other grant, is this Wednesday and Thursday in San Francisco. And they're having the first part of that meeting on Wednesday morning is in open session. It's at the Monaco Hotel in San Francisco. I don't have the address handy, but that's 8 to 11 a.m. Wednesday morning in San Francisco. You can get specific information on the Institute's website, which is www.crm.ca.gov.
All right. Thanks a lot for joining us, Jesse. Thanks for calling.
My pleasure, Christina. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was just Jesse Reynolds from the Center for Genetics and Society talking about Proposition 71 and the massive controversies surrounding that bill that passed last year. We're going to take a break. Here's Country Joe McDonald with Sexist Pig, and we'll be back with the week's calendar.
That ain't the solution, sexist, big sexist, big. 'Cause he's a man who thinks he can have any woman, sexist, big sexist, big. And he'll never find no peace of mind 'cause he's anti-human, sexist.
You are listening to Enemy Combatant Radio, our weekly newscast broadcast on 87.9 FM, Pirate Cat Radio. This is Christina, and Mark is also in the house.
Oh, yeah.
And we're going to give you this week's calendar. On Tuesday, August 2nd, which is tomorrow at 6 o'clock, the World Affairs Council presents Ambassador Carlos Pascual, coordinator of the U.S. Department of State's Office of Reconstruction and Stabilization. Pascual will discuss conflict prevention and management, meeting today's security challenges. Ambassador Pascual is the first coordinator of this new bureau and has difficult task of trying to anticipate the potential for instability and figure out what combinations of aid, technical assistance, and perhaps even military action might be necessary to head off shaky governments before it degenerates. We could apply that to the Bush administration today.
It does say bring a bag lunch, all you tomato lovers out there.
All right. This event is at the World Affairs Council, 312 Sutter Street, second floor in San Francisco. Program at 6, $5 with ID, non-members 15, co-sponsor 7.
And on Tuesday, the 2nd at 7 p.m., Oakland will have its first annual Jackson Street Family Block Party on 15th Street and Jackson in downtown Oakland in an effort to bring neighbors together. Research shows that neighborhoods are safer when residents know each other. So this is your invitation to strengthen your neighborhood by participating in this block party. Each registered block party will... Where did this come from?
This was the posting on Indie Bay.
Oh, okay.
Somebody posted.
I refuse
this
to read the rest
Bay.
Of it. But this is a free event from 7 to 9 p.m.
Firefighters will be there, and other city staff will also be there. Firefighters aren't bad.
They're
good.
I won't mention the other.
The cops will be there, but who cares about them? Okay.
The Border Shack, a five-day autonomous festival, will kick off on Wednesday, August 3rd, on the California-Mexico border near San Diego and Tijuana at the Playa de Toros. The five-day festival will have music, alternative media, and workshops. The event is organized to support creative resistance, build community, and to oppose borders, neoliberalism, and the capitalist empire. The five-day festival is free, and organizers are welcoming workshop ideas. You can go to deletetheborder.org for more info.
And that event does not get a free visit by the Oakland Police Department, hopefully.
Yes. Kind of far away for that, anyhow.
On Wednesday, August 3rd, join 9 Supreme Court judges in San Francisco for a rubber stamp march against President Bush's appointment of John Roberts to the Supreme Court. The march will begin at UC Hastings College of Law, at 198 McAllister Street, and the rally will begin at 6:15 with a roundtable discussion about John Roberts, and then there will be a rally at the Civic Center. This is a free event.
And on Wednesday, August 3rd, here Anna Beltzer, a Jewish-American peace activist and Fulbright scholar, will share the personal stories and photographs from her experiences in the occupied Palestinian territories, where she worked with the International Women's Peace Service, documenting human rights abuses and supporting Palestinian nonviolent resistance to the occupation. Her presentation focuses on the daily life of Palestinians in the West Bank, the subject of her upcoming book. This is Wednesday, August 3rd, again at 7 p.m. at the New College Cultural Center, 766 Valencia Street, in the Mission, in San Francisco. It's free and open to the public. Donations are gratefully accepted. This is sponsored by the New College Center for Education and Social Action.
Okay, 2 minutes left. Coming up this weekend, Saturday the 6th, there's going to be a seminar in Oakland, and this is 2 p.m. at the Unitarian Universalist Church at Cedar and Bonita in Berkeley. It's about the mental health system and the prison system. People will be discussing the similarities and interworkings of the mental health system with prisons, criminal justice, the youth authority, and the racism and abuse, which is endemic to all of these state systems. Speakers will include Peter Maiden, an Indie Bay journalist, Misha Monge-Izari, who is the creator of the Idris Deli Foundation, and other experts in the field will be there as well. For more information, you can email bayareamfsci@sbcglobal.net. And one more thing, Seeds of Change is having its No Nuke protest against the nukes in Livermore, and this is an annual protest. This is going to be at 5800 Patterson Pass Road in Livermore. There will be a shuttle from the BART station in Dublin Pleasanton. And this is the 60th anniversary of the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And this will include a potluck, picnic dinner, children's activities, and candlelight march to the gates of the lab.
All right, and on a similar kind of radical note, there's going to be a play, not so heavy. There's going to be a play in honor of Karl Marx. This is Howard Zinn's one-man play, Marx in Soho, starring Jerry Levy as Karl Marx, directed by Michael Fox Kennedy, on Saturday, April 6th at 2 o'clock, $10 in advance, $20 at the door. This is for Bay Area United Against War at John Sims Center, 1519 Mission Street, between 11th and South Van Ness. Starts at 2 o'clock. It's 3 hours long this Saturday.
And if you're heading to the anti-nuke protest in Livermore, take a camera and post some pictures to IndieBay, because we need some photographers out there to cover it. And that's going to be Saturday again in Livermore.
And that wraps it up for this week's edition of the IndieBay Weekly Newscast. Thanks, everyone, for contributing and posting your news. Remember, you can be the